Hello, and welcome to today's MTC presentation. My name is Blake Wodas, and I'll be hosting the session today. During the session, if you have any questions, please post them to the Q&A window, and we will address them at the end of the session. So today, we'll be looking to cover the Internet of Things. And during the presentation, we'll discuss the history of IoT, how it can be used in different industries, and how Microsoft tools and technologies can assist. So at this time, I'd like to turn it over to Joshua Davis, who will be our presenter today.
Thank you, Blake. Thank you guys for joining us today. First of all, I've got to apologize. I've got a little bit of a sore throat. We've had some cold weather here in Atlanta, and I've unfortunately contracted a cold over the week. You know, Blake, I've tried to kind of work outside for the past couple of days, and I've really had a hard time doing that. I've had a hard time, you know, breathing and working out at the same time. You know what I mean?
I do.
Yeah, for some odd reason, I keep fogging up my windows. Anyway, just kidding. So yeah, we're going to be talking about the IoT. What is the IoT? And before we begin, let me just introduce myself a little bit more. I'm a cloud solutions architect here at the MTC in Atlanta. And my focus areas are IoT, Azure, and app dev. And while I'm going through this slide, if you don't mind, please feel free to ping Blake in the chat window and let us know where you guys are from. Also, tell us what you're doing with IoT. We kind of like to hear from you guys and see what's going on in your neck of the woods. Also, you'll see from the screen that I've got quite a bit of development experience, multiple platforms, multiple languages, and a little bit of certifications from Microsoft and some Scrum certifications. And then also, I'm an outdoor enthusiast. Love hiking, camping, mountain biking, kayaking, all that good stuff. A couple ways to contact me. I've got a blog, LinkedIn, Twitter handle on the screen. Also, this presentation is what we'd consider a 100-level presentation. What that means is we're not going to get really too technical today. This presentation is really geared more to the business stakeholder, C-level position, CXO, the business development manager, directors, and such. But Blake, I would really encourage our users to really go out to my blog, subscribe. The reason being is because I did a really technical discussion at our Microsoft Ignite, and part of that whole session is actually going to be pushed out to my blog this week or next week. I've been working on it for a while to get all the details out there. So if you're really interested in implementing this, if you're a developer, a product manager, that type of thing, please go out to my blog, subscribe, and check out those posts as they're coming out live this week. I've also got some upcoming posts on some IoT features in Azure that you might also find interesting. I don't have my email on the screen, but if you really want to reach out to me personally, not only can you reach out to us through the chat today, but my email address is simply joshua.davis@microsoft.com. So again, joshua.davis@microsoft.com.
All right, great. Thank you, Joshua. So as we get started today, I think it's, you know, very interesting to understand, you know, how do we get to IoT? So understand a little bit more about the history and the different things that have kind of come along over the last 20 or 30 years.
Awesome, yeah. It's funny because when we think of IoT, a lot of people think about these small devices, these chipboards, Pis, Dragon Boards, Arduinos, to name a couple. And we kind of really miss the concept of what IoT really is. And so what I want to do is I want to take a kind of a step back in time to kind of see how we got to IoT. And hopefully that'll make a little bit more sense, give us some context around what IoT really is. And so so that's what I'm going to do first. Blake, what was your introduction to internet? When did you get started with the internet?
It's probably early to mid 90s with different bulletin board systems than some of the early versions of, you know, Netscape.
Gotcha. Yeah, I started out with Netscape too, and then kind of moved over to Internet Explorer once Netscape left us. But yeah, like everything, like me, the internet was born at a really young age, and it kind of started out with ARPANET. Back in the 1980s, we had ARPANET that was, you know, Blake, really only available to government and higher learning education. Fortunately, when I was a kid, I had access to ARPANET, and my dad worked at a university over in Alabama that was part of the Alabama Supercomputer Network, or ASN. And, you know, I was blessed to have the opportunity of working with the internet back then, back in the mid-80s. And in that time period, we really only had two ways to communicate with people in ARPANET. One was email, obviously, and the second is the second item you see on the screen, listservs. And all listservs really were was this electronic mailing list software that you would email, and multiple people would subscribe to this listserv, and they'd get your email, and then they were able to respond. And so you could think of it today as, again, just a simple mailing list software. Well, in the early 1990s, we also had this thing, this concept called bulletin board systems. And with bulletin boards, some of you may not know what these are, but, you know, Blake, you already said it. I'm very familiar with bulletin boards. I was also a huge fan, huge user, had a modem, made these weird noises as it dialed into the internet and or dialed into these systems, and we could download all types of software. Okay. What kind of stuff did you download?
I mean, songs.
Okay.
Songs, games, kind of older versions of movies were kind of some of the first opportunities.
Yeah, my stuff was, I was a big player of .NET New, or excuse me, not .NET Nuke, Duke Nukem,
yes.
And Wolfenstein 3D. The crazy thing about it was, with my modem being so slow, I would sit there at night waiting for two and a half, sometimes 3 hours, watching these little ASCII smiley faces or bricks go across the screen, trying to wait for this thing to download and you know, get 90, 95% completed, and guess what happens?
Lose power.
No, somebody picks network. Up the phone. And then I have to start the whole download all over again. And so then, you know, at that point, it's just time to go to bed. Hopefully you wake up and you can download it again during the night while you're sleeping. And hopefully it's completed by that point. But yeah, bulletin board systems was a craze back in the 1990s. And I remember when we got a Pentium 4 and 28.8 baud modems, that was the bomb.com. Just that 2.5 hours download time really decreased to 45 minutes or so. Then we get into the internet. Now, when you look at listservs, a precursor to the internet was really what we were doing with listservs. There was really a crawler out there that would crawl through the content of listservs and create static content. And then we'd use browsers. Prior to Netscape, we'd use browsers such as Lynx, which was nothing more than a green screen, and then we would just kind of navigate through these documents. And if you're familiar with Unix or Linux, right, it was very similar to a man page. Mm-hmm. So when you talk about designing the earlier web pages, there was no design to it. It was just basically text. So the internet came along in the late 1990s, and we considered the internet a network of networks. In other words, what we did was we took these corporate local networks and we connected them all. And it allowed corporations to communicate with each other and communicate with those higher learning educational institutions and in the government. And so that was our first access to the internet, the public internet. And around that time, we started adding images and using things like Netscape, and CompuServe was big, AOL. And so that was what the internet really started out in its infancy. Late 1990s, we also had blogs. They were nothing more, really, than personal diaries.
Yep.
And people would write these daily or sometimes weekly articles, and people would come in and supply comments, write comments, communicate with the blog writer. Very similar to forums, but the whole concept, the whole differentiation between blogs and forums was blogs was this one-to-many where one person was writing and many people would respond, where forums was multiple people writing and then multiple people responding. And it wasn't really until the 2010s where this concept of blogs having multiple authors. Then we get to 1999, RSS feeds, introduced by Netscape, actually. And what they were looking for, a way to take web content and create a metadata structure around that content that that could be consumed by disparate systems. Look at that content, index it, break it down, and use it within various applications. And then we get to IoT in 1999. The IoT idea, smart devices, was first discussed as early as 1982 at Carnegie Mellon University. Now, Blake, let me ask you a question. What would you consider to be the first IoT device?
Probably something like some kind of connected vending machine.
Okay, and believe it or not, most people would attribute the Coca-Cola machine as that first IoT device. But in reality, today, looking back on history, we would really consider ATMs in the mid-1970s as our true first IoT device. And IoT, or the Internet of Things, was first coined in 1985. But the concept of IoT, again, as you see on the screen, didn't really become popular until 1999. Now, why do I look at all of this stuff and really discuss this on the screen? Well, I really want you kind of to understand what IoT really is. It's not simply devices. It's not, you know, Dragon Boards or Pis or Arduinos or our kitchen appliances being connected to the internet. IoT really revolves around data. If you look at the screen and look at ARPANET all the way up to even BBSs, the data and the amount of change across that data, the data was very stagnant. The data really only changed in bulletin board systems when maybe a file was uploaded, content by the bulletin board administrator changed, and the same thing really happened with the internet. Once those listserv documents were indexed and pushed out to the internet in its early beginnings, the content didn't really change. When we created HTML pages, HTML 1.0 or 2.0 prior to the introduction of JavaScript, it was one of those things where we would really get out there and publish it, leave it, and forget it. And unless we really needed to update the content, there was no point in going out there and updating those pages. When blogs came around, it was we saw the content changing a lot more rapidly. Blogs were written by people around events. Perhaps you guys may be blogging about today's webcast. Please send me a link if you do. But the blogs are published a day or sometimes even the day of a conference, and multiple people are writing on those blogs. People who, Blake, aren't able to attend can go out to those blogs, see what's discussed, mm-hmm. and really kind of get in on the know of what's going on. Right. With IoT, we take that one step further. With IoT, it's about not just taking data that's happening once or changing once a day or once a week or once a month, but IoT is all about producing millions and millions of data points and then consuming those within milliseconds. So when we think about IoT, don't think about necessarily the device and ending at the device. Think about the production of all those data points and then the rapid consumption of those of that same data. And that's really what IoT is all about. And then when you take it one step further is, all right, how do we do that? How do we consume that data, how do we manipulate it, and get the data out or the reporting out of the data that we're gathering.
So as we kind of look through the history of IoT, I mean, where do you see it going over the next 10 to 15 years?
Great question. So in the next decade, I've got a couple of quotes you'll see on the screen, but IDC thinks that by 2020, we're going to see a $7.1 trillion market for IoT. That's a 16.9% compound in annual growth. Additionally, Cisco estimates that by the year 2020, that where we have currently 15 billion devices today in the market, we're probably going to see somewhere around 50 billion devices. Yeah. Intel estimates 200 billion, and there's some estimates out there, Blake, that even go as high as 215 billion.
Wow.
So we have a huge opportunity as we're looking at the future of IoT.
That's right. So as we talk about the history and the future, so how can IoT work across different industries?
Yeah, again, another great question. I've got a couple of slides here that I want to kind of look at some verticals to see how certain companies see IoT playing a role in their industry. Here's one for energy. In 2025, IoT could generate more than $11 trillion when you look at public services, such as transit, operations management. Another interesting thing on this slide is customer relationship management. What if you could take IoT and predict behaviors around your customers or your client base? Would that allow you to increase sales? Well, I'm going to, in a couple slides from now, look at some ways that we may be able to do that. So let's keep that in the back of our mind, but specifically regarding energy, Barcelona estimates that IoT has saved them $58 million annually from connected water management and $37 million just in street lighting. GE estimates that connected industrial machinery will contribute $10 to $15 trillion in global GDP within the next 20 years. And it also believes that using IoT-enabled machinery to make oil and gas exploration and discovery just 1% more efficient could result in a savings of $90 billion. For the consumer, you look at different verticals like automotive, home, computing, wearables. 90% of cars will be connected by 2020. 1.9 billion connected home devices, estimating $490 billion in revenue. Computing, in 2017, IoT market is expected to surpass tablets, phone, and PCs. And then wearables, when consumers were interviewed and said, how does the wearable contribute to your efficiency at home and both even in the workplace? They said at the home, it really increases our efficiency probably somewhere around 80%, and then at work, as much as 78%. And there's other verticals, Blake, such as sports, athletes, mm-hmm. NASCAR, health. What if, we hear about these commercials on TV that says, by taking this medication, we expect you to see results in X amount of time. But that's really generic. What if we could proactively administer a drug to a patient and over time see how that individual patient responds to that drug, not within days or not within weeks, but almost immediately, how does the body respond to that drug? It may in fact reduce healthcare costs because we can treat patients a lot quicker, more efficiently, more effectively.
Right, so it's definitely more of a proactive approach.
Oh, absolutely. And even in livestock and produce, there's stories out there where we're tagging pigs, got to protect the bacon, tagging pigs to see how they are responding, how healthy they are, if they're eating at the trough. What they're doing is they're seeing how often the pig actually visits the trough to make sure it's eating. If a pig isn't eating, then that's a good sign that the pig's sick, and so what they want to do is remove the pig from the rest of the pigs and treat that pig, otherwise it could get the rest of the pigs sick. And so watching those costs there. Again, cows, monitoring milk production, monitoring if they're pregnant, all kinds of stuff. So there's a ton of stuff we're doing with IoT that really just don't have time to cover in the slides. Now, I want to get back to episode one. We're kind of coming to an end with this series of looking at our data. And in episode one, we talked about looking at a bike store and looking at getting deep into bike sales and reporting on that, helping us make some educated decisions around bikes and some marketing decisions, if you would. And so I want to look specifically at our retail industry and say, well, how does IoT play in retail? So I've got a couple points I want to bring out to you in this. First of all, track inventory. By tracking inventory, we can reduce the need of actually taking inventory. When I was in college, I had the opportunity of working for Eddie Bauer at the mall. Had to make a living. And so I remember closing down the store for a couple days while we did inventory. And I know that tracking inventory is crucial to a store, but it also reduces the amount of revenue that a store can actually produce while the doors are closed. And so if we had IoT devices within individual products, we could track where those products are in the store and reduce the amount of time needed to take inventory. It also allows us to find products within the store. Blake, let me ask you a question. Have you ever been to a box store where you are being proactive, say, hey, I need this product. You look it up on your phone. You see it that the store says, we have two of those items in store. You go to the store, you know exactly where it's supposed to be. You look on the shelf, lo and behold, it's not there.
Yeah, I mean, it happens all the time. Bookstores, I mean, especially around the holiday season, that's something that, you know, is really, it's not, we don't want to have to deal with it as we're doing last minute shopping.
Absolutely. And what's worse for me is you go to the attendant and they pull up their computer and their computer says, well, yeah, we're supposed to have two on the floor. They take you exactly where you just came from and they can't seem to find it either. So with IoT, we can help reduce that frustration. We know from marketing and results in marketing that most people make purchasing decisions based on emotions. And really, you have about 14 seconds to make an emotional appeal to a consumer in order to make that sale. And if the consumer has not made an emotional connection within about 14 seconds, then more than likely you're not going to make a sale. So the amount of time it takes for a consumer to find the product on the shelf reduces the likelihood that you are making that sale. And if they can't find the product within 14 seconds, they may rationalize and say, you know what, there's probably a different way I can solve my task. I may not need that product, and so the store loses out on a potential sale. So with IoT, we are able to increase increase the speed of the sale and reduce the amount of time it takes for a user or a customer to find that product. Additionally, monitor shelf life. So with this, stores most of the time have a quota or have a timeline that they give to a product manufacturer, and they say your product has to sell within X amount of days or we won't carry it. And so by monitoring the shelf life, they can actually see, well, how long did it take to make the sale? Now, yeah, you can do that with descriptive analytics after the sale, but wouldn't it be nice to see that within the process? Also, looking at things like produce. If we knew that, take a bunch of bananas. Blake, have you, when you go shopping, do you take a bunch of bananas and look at them first, make sure you get the right bananas before you?
Yeah, you need to pick them up, feel them, make sure there's no bad spots, you know, they're yellow or green. Kind of make that decision as we're feeling them and touching them.
Sure, and how many bunches do you feel like you would probably pick up before you got the right one?
Probably two or three.
Yeah, and I'm sure that a lot of other people do the same thing. So what if a store could monitor how many times that particular produce was picked up, was handled, and then they could have some type of metric around that and say, all right, after X amount of times, a store clerk needs to go in and shuffle the bunches so that particular bunch isn't handled, because after a while, after it's been touched by X amount of people, that particular item may not be worthy to be sold. And so they would have to remove that from their shelf and lose out on potential revenue. On the fly promotions. Now, I've got four kids, love them to death, and it was interesting when I went and shopped at Kroger. I would, as I'm checking out, Kroger gives you these coupons that you can use for things like when I was having the kids, they noticed that I was buying formula, diapers, baby powder, all that stuff. And so they were nice enough to give me these coupons as I checked out. Well, unfortunately, sometimes those coupons get lost. Sometimes, based on what I'm doing, I may not return to Kroger to buy those items. I may go to a different store and purchase those items. And so a store like that who are operating in more of a reactive mode to consumer behavior, they may miss out on that sale. What if a store could use IoT to determine and be proactive in giving users on-the-fly promotions via a mobile device or whatever the case may be, through text or through a mobile app or something like that, so that while I'm still shopping, forget about waiting to the checkout line, while I'm still shopping, I can say, hey, that's something I want. Let me go ahead and pick that up. That's something I need. Or if there's a special now and I know that I'm going to be out in a week or two, I might as well go ahead and stock up on it, and therefore it increases the likelihood of the sale for the retail store. So on-the-fly promotions, obviously there's a potential increase in sales there. Improved customer experience. You know, with clothing, they have the little ink tags. What if we could tap into those ink tags and have some type of RFID chip, maybe an iBeacon device that you really could monitor how many times that piece of clothing was taken to the dressing room. What about multiple sizes? Maybe the customer says, you know what, this size doesn't fit me. I need to get a different size. Well, a couple things around that whole scenario. What if you saw that as a trend over a particular item? Maybe customers are hitting their normal size on a particular item, and more oftentimes than not, they're having to get a larger size or a smaller size, whatever the case may be. Well, as a store associate, you could be proactive in saying, I bet you that customer is probably going to need a different size. Let me go ahead and be proactive and respond to them and get them the size they need. Blake, let me tell you a story. I love telling stories. So in college, like I said, I worked for Eddie Bauer, and Eddie Bauer focused on selling two things, clothing and dog toys. Apparently there was a huge deal with targeting our little friends and giving them toys for outside play and stuff. So when I worked there, I'd always sell 300, 400% of my manager set goals. And one day my manager asked me, how in the world do you do that? And I told him it's simple. I'm not here to sell clothes. And he looks at me, he says, what do you mean? We're a clothing store. And I said, well, it's easy. Because we're a clothing store, I know that the customer is coming in and looking at clothes. I believe in the product, so my responsibility while they're in the store is to make sure that they're enjoying their time in the store. And so I did everything possible to make sure that they enjoyed their time. And so if it was a mom coming in bringing a kid, then I would take out one of our dog toys. We had some tennis balls there. and play with the kid while the mom shopped. And all the time, moms constantly bought $400, $500 worth of clothes from me because she said, this is the first time all day I've had the opportunity to actually shop. I remember also one time, you know, Christmas is coming up, and this little lady comes in one time and she says, you know, I don't have a lot of money, and I'm trying to look for something that I can buy for my grandkids. Do you have anything? And we're always told to upsell on things like socks and belts and knickknacks, and look for that extra squeeze in revenue. And I said, well, have you considered socks? And she said, well, it's a great idea, and it's something I could probably afford, but I have arthritis in my hands. It's very hard for me to wrap presents.
Right.
I said, well, you know what? We don't have any wrapping paper in the store, but I see that you have wrapping paper in your shopping bag. If you'll buy the socks, I'll wrap the presents for you right here in the store. And she says, all right, let's do that. And so she bought six pairs of socks. She went up to my manager, started crying. She said, this is the best store ever. And so it's all about that customer experience and building that customer relationship. And so with IoT, we want to look for ways to be proactive. We want to make sure that we're addressing our customers' needs before they even know they had those needs. We can also track, again, how many times an item is returned to the dressing room, or maybe it's just this item is not selling. So again, tracking items throughout the store. And then finally, evaluating customer behavior. Now, We call this behavior-driven marketing. But what it means is simply, how is the customer responding while they're in the store? What is our marketing efforts doing? A lot of companies, a lot of retail stores spend millions of dollars planning out store layouts, planning out the signage, thinking that if we put this item next to this item, then it would increase the likelihood of sales. And we do that really reactively based on reports and data. But again, I want to think in a proactive strategy. So with evaluating customer behavior, I've got right here in front of me, and this is just simply an Xbox Kinect device. It's nothing more than a camera. I'm just using it as an example. But a lot of stores, believe it or not, and you may not even see this, but a lot of stores are placing hidden cameras on shelves. Now, I don't want you to think about them invading privacy. They're not doing that. What they're doing is they're taking marketing behavior one step further. They're looking at how you respond to item placement on the shelf, such as facial recognition. If, you know, I'm thinking of scent stores. My wife sends me into stores to look at candles and perfume, and those places give me headaches. But anyway, I have to go in there, and these cameras are set to, well, how does this customer respond to this scent? Is a husband thinks this is great or awful or whatnot? Because with Christmas coming around the corner, you may have a lot of husbands coming in buying these scents for their wives. And so if that's the case, you may want to put those types of products, those products that are favored by the husbands, in a more prominent position. Additionally, determining how long an individual will stand at a product before taking action, such as picking it up, trying it on, even making a purchase. With facial recognition, I can see and monitor a customer coming and looking at the product saying, well, they stood here for X amount of minutes, maybe looked at some tags, maybe they picked it up, maybe they put it back. Tracking this not only in that one instance, but how many times did the customer come back to the store and look at the same product? So a lot of our data, a lot of our reports are looking at sales after the fact, after they've already happened. But do we really, from a retail perspective, do we really have a good grasp on the cost of goods sold or the cost of the sale from the user experience all the way to action? And with IoT and the art of the possible in IoT, we can kind of help get a better, more clear picture around user or customer behavior with our products.
So with all these different, you know, technologies and IoT needs out there, I mean, how can Microsoft tools and technologies help support these initiatives?
Yeah, well, let's take a look. So Microsoft Azure is a very, very mature platform for handling IoT. We have some devices looking at supporting a ton of different devices for IoT. Maybe these are devices such as you know, again, your Raspberry Pis, your Arduino boards, Dragon boards, so forth and so on. Maybe it's industrial equipment. A lot of companies already are doing IoT. They've been doing IoT since the 70s because these industrial machines are capturing all this data. They're just saving it to tapes somewhere and not really doing anything with it. So we've got these machines out there that are already capturing a lot of data, and we've already looked at other devices by 2020 that will also have data. So taking some type of data, pushing it up into some connectivity pieces in Azure, anything from Event Hub, IoT Hub specifically, maybe it's storing some type of message. And this is again, forgive me, but this is our technical slide of this entire deck. So some of our technical audience may appreciate this a little bit more. But with our device connectivity, sending those messages up to the service bus, and even getting data from external data sources. And then how do we store that data? Again, Azure has a ton of opportunities and a ton of options for storing data, then working with that data, massaging that data. One thing that's not even listed on the analytics piece is functions. Looking at little bits and pieces of data and working over those and creating algorithms around our data, even machine learning being proactive, being prescriptive, descriptive around what are our customers doing out in the field. And then finally, once we've created our data, gathered it, created it, massaged it, how do we view it? Microsoft has done an incredible job at presentation of that data through reporting, SSRS, even our Power BI platform is amazing, allowing people that really aren't tech savvy to really get some really good insights on their data and explore that using native language query, being able to ask questions into an app and getting the data that they're actually looking for.
So as you kind of look at, you know, how do we adopt these types of technologies and strategies? What are the things that companies can do to kind of plan for that type of future?
Yeah, so I did actually create a slide for that. And this slide is really, really for the decision makers, those people that are considering putting IoT in the enterprise. And these are about 8 points that I want you to kind of just keep in the back of your mind and kind of think about this, work with your architects, work with your project managers and your other business stakeholders as you're looking at doing some type of IoT. Mm-hmm. And just kind of walk through this. This is more along the lines, this is some questions for you to consider, but architecting for change. Don't use what we consider monolithic application development standards. Write applications that are modular, that are using things like dependency injection, applications where you can plug and play different pieces, different components within your IoT app. That way, if you need to switch out a dependency or switch out a library, maybe one of those libraries gets old, no longer supported, you're not having to rewrite the entire app. You can just switch out that one component and continue moving forward with your application and your IoT. Making products updatable in the field. There are a lot of places where you may put IoT devices, maybe it's high, maybe it's low, maybe it's way out in the middle of nowhere, where it's very inefficient and not very economical to send a tech support guy out there on the field to replace a device or do an upgrade for the application or the operating system. So you really want to think about, how am I going to deploy upgrades to these devices while they're out in the field so I'm not having to send a live person out there to do those manually? Assess vendor and technology viability regularly. What vendors and what technologies are you using to build your IoT systems? You know, there's a couple of them out there. Microsoft has a great one, the Windows IoT Core. Microsoft has done some great exploration, some great development, some great planning around our IoT offering. I would encourage any person to look into that. It supports a ton of different technologies that many of the developers are already familiar with. We also have other technologies such as Node, JavaScript, if you would, that, again, a lot of familiarity, a lot of support, but these are two technologies that aren't going anywhere. When you look at supporting these devices in the long run, make sure you're not picking a technology that not a lot of people are using that you can't find a lot of support with and that a company may go out of business, a company that you're using or that's supporting a specific driver or whatnot in your application. And let's be honest, let's identify an exit strategy. And with this, I also want to talk about very quickly, it's okay to fail. You may think about adopting IoT in your enterprise and invest in some prototypes, developing some prototypes, and you realize, you know what? By developing the prototypes, I actually realized what the true problem is, and IoT isn't the answer. So, you know, prototypes are great in that you can maybe look at the devices that you already have deployed and create good solutions to problems that you didn't know that you had or you didn't really know what the true problem was. And then if you do consider investing in IoT, then make sure that you have a backup strategy, especially for things like power connectivity, internet connectivity. Look at your SLAs. If you have something where you're required to provide data real time, ask the question to yourself, what is real time to us? Because a lot of companies say real time is within a week, within a month. Some companies say real time is right now. So what is real time to you? And then again, look at your SLA, look at your commitments as far as delivering that data, because something like shopping habits is probably, I mean, not necessarily to a retail store, but in the grand scheme of things, shopping habits are probably a lot less priority than, let's say, medical information that you're tracking on a patient. So what is your SLA as far as if that data does not come through within a given amount of time? Form risk assessments. How will inaccurate data expose risk for your company, whether that's social, commercial, technical? Is there, again, any liability involved if the data is incorrect? What is my SLA to people who are consuming my data? And how will you mitigate those risks? How will you address the situation if you do, in fact, come across exposure? Develop a security strategy. Now, this is a big one, and I've got a couple of points here, but just want to bring this out. You may think that your internal network is secure, and you've done a lot to shore up those defenses with your internal network, but you can think of these IoT devices, when you join them to the enterprise, think about them as edge appliances, that they're out there where people can access them. They may not necessarily need to remotely log into them. These devices may be local to those people, where somebody could take a computer and just plug directly into it. How will you prevent unauthorized access? With unauthorized access, there's a ton of news stories out there where people have used IoT devices for things like device impersonation. There we go. I can't even say the word. DDoS attacks, hacking, and exposure to PII. Also, brand damage. If you've got a software library that you've deployed that's intellectual property, you don't want that falling into the wrong hands for people to, you know, do reverse engineering on that, breaking down your code and seeing your trade secrets. Conduct feasibility studies around your security, and then identify any liabilities. And then finally, construct a sensible data architecture. With that, look at the data that your device is gathering. What is the amount of data on the size of the disk? And typically these IoT devices aren't using spinning disk or SSDs. They're using small micro SD chips. What is the amount of data that your device is storing? Or what is the amount of data that your device can store? How about the data in transit? Consider your bandwidth. How much data are you sending up the internet? Your data read-write speed and accessibility. How fast can that device read and write data from its chip? Or if it's pulling data from a remote source, how fast does it need to have access to that data? Data encryption at rest and at transit. And then also cloud versus some cloud. So do you want all your data to exist in the cloud, or do you want some data to be existing locally for other IoT devices to connect and view that data? And that's something that we call fog architecture, not necessarily cloud, but looking at these IoT devices, allowing them to communicate with each other and then share the data, and then maybe one or two devices pushing that data up into Azure. So that, again, that's something we consider fog architecture.
Well, thank you, Josh. I wanted to kind of address a few questions that came in during the presentation. So with the deluge of new data streaming into Azure or to any of these kind of hubs, you know, how can retailers, like a brick and mortar store, you know, how can they make visual or analytical sense kind of in real time to really optimize that customer interaction?
So what I would recommend is really enabling and training your sales associates. Again, there may be some people that on your sales force who may not necessarily be the right people, the technologically savvy, and that's okay, but you may have a couple people on your sales force who are. And so by writing applications or developing dashboards with Power BI, and we have a mobile BI component of Power BI, allowing those sales associates to have access to those dashboards, they can monitor and track how products are doing in real time out there on the shelves. And again, I talked about a couple scenarios, but allowing them to see, well, this customer is trying on different jeans or different pants, different clothing items. And so you can allow that or equip that sales associate to say, you know what, let me go and pull a couple of other things. They may be looking at jeans, they've tried this size, they've tried this style, and they're not having a lot of luck, but they really like this particular brand or this particular style. It really equips the sales associate to have some meaningful, engaging, educated conversations with your customers.
Yeah. So one last question. So we talked about some of the kind of the in-store beacons and the fact that some of the consumers, they've got Bluetooth, they have, you know, smartphone, and we can address kind of mobile marketing efforts. You know, how can that interaction between the data that the stores have and the users, you know, applications and their smartphone, how can customers really personalize that to their shopping experience?
So go back to the box store. Blake, again, we talked about the scenario where I can't find a product,
right,
and hunting that down. But let's say you were able to find the product. Let's say we're going to a store and you need to do some home repairs. And more than likely, you know, I've got a couple of kids. How old are your kids?
3 and 8.
Okay, so 8-year-old, I've got a 9 and a 7 as well. And let's say they get rambunctious. My 5-year-old son is extremely rambunctious and they puncture a hole in the wall. Well, you've got to, you know, patch that hole up. And depending on the hole, the size of that hole, you may need different materials. So let's say it's a rather large hole and you need to go and purchase some drywall. So you take the drywall, you put it in your cart. From a consumer perspective, I don't necessarily want to go around the store trying to figure out, all right, what do I need? Especially if I'm not really savvy in what I do need to fix that hole. I know I need drywall, but what else? What kind of tape do I need? What kind of plaster, a knife, a putty knife?
Right.
What other things do I need to fix that hole? And then even how do I do it? Is there a YouTube video that I could download, or is there a store video that the store has created to show me how to do this?
Right.
So increasing the customer experience where they take an item, they place it in their shopping cart, and then they're educated on the different uses of that particular item, and then accompanying products that go along with that item.
Right.
We're looking at upsells, and we're also looking at a greater customer experience where they can go out there and increase your revenue.
Okay, great. Well, that's all the questions that we have right now, so I think we're ready to wrap up.
Okay, awesome. Thank you guys for coming out. Real quick, just want to let you know, 2 upcoming engagements. I'm speaking at DevNexus in Atlanta the last week in February, talking on advanced TypeScript. So if you want to come out there, see me, get an autograph. It won't be any of my books because, well, I haven't written any books, but bring someone else's book and I'll be happy to autograph theirs. And then also I'm scheduled to talk another Channel 9 session if they let me come back the last week of February. We'll be talking about cloud planning and optimizing spending, looking at our budgets around cloud and cloud operations. So again, thank y'all so much for joining us today. Blake, thank you so much for hosting, and y'all have a great day.